So let's begin with our topic for today, which is how do you love yourself? And remember that we were brought up to believe that self-love is selfishness. And so we're trying to free ourselves from that perspective and look at things in a new and healthy way. So we will say that self-love is the equivalent of caring about three things. You're caring about your health, and so you are doing whatever maintains your health. That's a form of self-love. Not selfish, just self-nurturance. Secondly, you're caring about maintaining a basically happy life to whatever extent you can, and bringing happiness to others fits with that. And then finally, how do I take everything that happens to me in the course of the day and make it an opportunity for personal growth? And this growth could be psychological or spiritual. So when I heard the announcer say that the fire was near Camarillo, and I had my response, and then I turned it into a prayer, his announcement was an opportunity for me to engage in some personal growth in a spiritual way. Spiritual would have to do with how do I make connections far and wide with people that I don't even know. Psychological has to do with how do I work on myself so that I don't come from a place of anxiety and compulsion. So what is caring about myself? Since I was given a body-mind, it is up to me to tend it the way a shepherd tends the sheep, T-E-N-D. And so I'm tending my health and I'm tending my happiness by being in relationships that are not abusive, for instance, that would be an example. And I'm tending my personal growth by taking everything that happens as an opportunity for it. And opportunity, that word in spiritual language would be grace. Graces come to us in the form of opportunities to grow in our spiritual world. And as far as I'm concerned, graces come to us for our psychological work also. So everybody on board with this basic concept? And the fact that we were taught that loving yourself was a form of selfishness, it may take a while for us to free ourselves from that old belief. I remember when the first time I was on a plane and the stewardess said, put the mask on yourself first and then on your children. I was shocked. I thought, what? We're supposed to think of others first. And then it made sense to me. I thought, well, I have to be in a good, clear state of mind so I can help them. So, secondly, we did not come into the world knowing how to love. We came in with a capacity to love. But then we had to learn how to show it. So you came into the world with a capacity to dance, but then you had to learn the various steps so you could be able to do it with a certain amount of grace. We came in with the capacity to love. We learn how. How do we learn? We learn by seeing how others loved us. And since they loved us by tending to our needs, that gives us the clue about how to love ourselves. We love ourselves when we take care of ourselves the way our parents took care of us. When they were taking care of us, taking care of what? Our health, our happiness, and our personal growth. When they were doing that in their own way, and some were more successful at others at doing it, of course, but when they were doing that, they were teaching us how to love ourselves. If you stop to think of it, part of growing up, so growing, refers to taking over the functions that our parents performed for us. So our parents put on our shoes at first and tied them. Then we took over the function of putting on our shoes, but couldn't tie them. They tied them for us. Then they showed us how to tie them. Now we are able to assume the functions that our parents originally were performing for us. And little by little, we assumed one function after another. First they fed us, then we fed ourselves. First they carried us around, then we learned to walk. So if you stop to think of it, growing up is assuming all the functions of the caretakers. The ones who had a caring connection toward us showed us how to care about ourselves. So this is how it becomes clear that humans need each other right from the beginning, and that love has something to do with how we were loved by others. That's how we learn to love ourselves, and then that's how we learn to love others. Okay, so that's fairly straightforward, but now I want to go on to another feature of this. This part is not in the book, but our psychology comes to us mainly from German men. So that would be Freud, Jung, Kohut. And they came up with a twofold way that we grow up and become adults. They said it takes separation from your parents and individuation. I'll explain these terms on our own. So the two developmental tasks that move us from childhood to adulthood, that is, from dependency to independence, we separate from the ones upon whom we were dependent, namely our parents, and then we individuate and establish our own independent way of living and thinking. First, we do what they want us to do, and then we become independent of what they want us to do, and we establish our own individuality. So individuation is you becoming your full self, conscious of your own needs, and values. You separate from the values that your parents had, if you choose to do so, or you embrace the values in a whole new way that's unique to you. So how does one grow up? One grows up through separation and individuation. This would be the state-of-the-art approach from the psychology that we were all brought up with. However, when we look at this carefully, some questions come up. For one thing, this concept of separation from your parents and family has a kind of Northern European flavor to it. This doesn't go for us Mediterranean people, because we maintain the connection for a long time. Secondly, this idea of individuating no longer fits for a world like ours, in which everything depends upon interconnection. The world of Freud back in 1905 was one that was comfortable with nation states that are all separate and each one has its own purposes. Now we have a global world, and the concept of separating out of it and of individuating starts to look somewhat antithetical to how this world will survive. This world will survive not through separation, but through connection. Not through individuation, independence, but through interdependence. So becoming an adult certainly means that you somehow separate from being totally dependent, but it's no longer to become independent, it's to become interdependent. And this word looks more like love, because interdependence is a connection, and love is a caring connection. So I'm separating and maintaining a connection, and I'm individuating, but at the same time remaining interdependent upon everyone else and with everyone else. Everybody follow? This is a whole new way of looking at what we were taught about the nature of growing up. Because this old way of growing up no longer works in a society like ours. And this new approach has more of a spiritual consciousness to it, because it has the accent on the connectedness and the accent on the interdependence. And when we move in this direction, what happens is a kind of, and this is another interesting thing, in object relations is a form of basically Freudian psychology that puts even more emphasis on what happened in early life. In fact, it breaks up the first 3 years into phases, like an autistic phase, symbiotic phase, so forth. And one of the phases of very early life is called symbiotic. You remember this word from high school biology? It means that the two beings are dependent upon each other for survival. And the fact that in the traditional psychology, this is considered a phase, that's one problem. And secondly, it's considered to apply only to infants. This is the phase in which you are so attached to your mother that you don't realize there's a difference between you. You don't know where mother ends and where you begin. This is the symbiotic phase. So now we need to rescue this word and say the society we're in now requires us to be symbiotic toward each other. And when we are this way, a synergy occurs. This word in Greek means work together. And working together, because we are symbiotically connected, because we need each other so much, makes it legitimate to need each other. Whereas in the original model, it isn't really legitimate anymore to need others, because you're supposed to be the Superman who individuates and is out there on his own. Totally. The rugged individualism, that would have been considered healthy. Now, it's considered dangerous, because we don't have a world like that anymore. We never did, really, but now it's even more obvious. Everybody following? And this applies spiritually also. And I want to give a very simple example of it. This part is in the book. I remember in high school, I went to a Catholic high school, and I remember sisters saying that the Sacred Heart had promised that if we went to Mass and received Holy Communion on 9 First Fridays, does that other people remember this? We would not die without a chance to receive the last rites. Everybody follow? The purpose of the Sacred Heart didn't really make promises, but the Jesuits who are the caretakers of devotion to the Sacred Heart, they took the basic message of the Sacred Heart, and they came up with these 12 promises, and this is the last one. This is number 12, and this is a big one, because at the time that all this was happening, 17th, 18th century, there was still a great concern about being sure that you had the chance to receive the last rites so that your soul would be saved. And so this promise is very meaningful. Secondly, the other hidden meaning of this promise is to encourage people to receive communion more frequently, because people were not receiving, they thought they were unworthy to receive communion. When you think that communion is a reward instead of a gift that's being given freely, then you won't be receiving it as much. So this was meant to encourage that. Anyway, the point I'm making is, when sisters told us this, I said to myself, oh, I have to be sure to do the 9 First Fridays so that I will be sure to receive the last rites. And only later in life did I realize, oh, you were thinking of it so in such an individual way. You were thinking, this is only about me saving my own soul. It didn't occur to me then. I could have said, and this is what I would say now, I could have said, well, I want to do the First Friday so that everybody gets the chance to have a peaceful death. See how different that is? That's the kind of consciousness that we want to move toward. And that fits with what I've just been saying about psychology. Because we were doing the same thing religiously that we were doing psychologically. It's all about me and how I individuate, how I get to the point of perfect health or perfect connection to God. And now we're looking at it in a new way. It's never only about me, it's about everyone. In fact, this has helped me in prayer. Instead of saying a prayer just for myself, I now, after asking, let's say, for what grace I'm wanting, I always add on, and may all people receive this same grace. So I'm recommending this to you. It's a new way of being in relation to humanity. So you never just say, may my son get off drugs. May the sons of all mothers go off drugs. Very simple. But it changes our perspective. It opens it up so that everything we want for ourselves, we also want for others. Everybody follow what I'm saying? Does this all make sense? I think it's a beautiful new consciousness. I found it through Buddhism, because in Buddhism we have a wonderful practice called loving kindness, in which you aspire to happiness and freedom from fear, first for yourself, then for those you care about, then for those with whom you have difficulties, love your enemies, then for those that you're neutral toward, and finally for all beings. So everything we ask is first for ourselves, and then it moves along until it embraces everyone. Something like the Sacred Heart itself. This is a metaphor, a symbol of the kind of love that comes to us from a higher power, comes to us from the universe. It never will reach only us. It's like the sun. It doesn't shine on one person. It shines on everyone. Always. Okay. Questions about this part so far? Okay, John, if you want to... And then...
Is the Sacred Heart the same as Jung's collective unconscious?
He's asking about Jung's distinction between... So first let me just mention what you're referring to. So of course we have a conscious life and an unconscious life. In other words, some things we're aware of and some parts of ourselves we're unaware of. That unaware part is the part that happens when you fall asleep. So the dreams come from the unconscious, whereas right now your conscious mind is having certain thoughts. So Jung said that in addition to having a personal unconscious, which contains all of your own personal memories and images, then there's also a collective unconscious that contains images that are meaningful to everyone. So the Sacred Heart is, of course, in this collective unconscious, because the heart is symbolic of love and openness in all cultures. Hence, it's a collective image. It's not a personal image. You can stare at him. Yes. Yes. He's saying the idea of a mystical body of Christ, which means at first it meant that the Catholic Church is the body of Christ on earth, and that each one of us is a cell in that body. Now we have a bigger view. This is another example of becoming more loving in our way of looking at things. The whole universe is the mystical body, not just the Catholic Church. Everybody follow? Jim, you had a question? So if you have a question, you can just come right up to the microphone, and then I will let you know.
In the Mediterranean model, the parental side of that often remains very controlling, which is not a good thing.
Yes, that's one of the... We're going to talk about the dark side of things. So the dark side of maintaining the connection is that you might become so enmeshed in your family that you're controlled by the people in your family, or you're overly dependent upon them. So that's one danger. Remember that the way to notice where dangers are. So let's just use that example of maintaining a connection. So maintain a connection with those who are close to you. So you place your topic in the middle, and then you want to draw an arrow going to the left and one going to the right. On one side, you have excess, and on the other side, you have deficiency. So too much of a connection will make you dependent and too little of a connection will make you so ruggedly individual that you will lose your sense of connection. So these two, the excess and the deficiency, are the equivalent of the dark side of connection. Because of connection, I could become too dependent, or because of connection, I could react and break from the connection and lose my connection. And both of those are dangerous. So there's a danger in excess and a danger in defect or deficiency. And this is why Aristotle said, the virtue is always in the middle. In Buddhism too, we have the middle way. So this is where you know, this is how you find the virtue. It's always in the middle. Let's use another simple example. Courage. But if there's too much courage, it's foolhardy. That's not a virtue, that's a danger. And if there's too little courage, you become passive, you don't stand up for yourself, so that's a danger. So courage will always, so the virtue will always be in the middle. Everybody see how that works? And that would be true of any of these topics. So if you place love in the middle, too much love is the codependency, and too little is the indifference. Somebody else had a question? Gordon?
I'm along the line what you were saying about a prayer for peace and everyone. In Hindu tradition, at least one spiritual teacher has a saying in Sanskrit, Om Loka Tamasoha Sukhino Bhavatu, which means, may all the beings in the universe be happy, healthy, and peaceful. And the interesting thing about it is that anyone in the world can say this if they're into this particular tradition and in that language. Everybody would understand what they mean. It's just kind of interesting.
Thank you for telling us that. That's a good example of how the collective unconscious, how there's a unity among all religions on certain realizations. Kind of gives you a sense of the legitimacy of our view, because it's been confirmed by so many sources. Okay. So on page 51, if you have your book handy, I just want to pay a little bit of attention to a topic we brought up last time, which were the five A's as ways of showing love. How do you know that someone loves you? He pays attention to you. He accepts you as you are. He appreciates what you do and appreciates you in general. He shows affection in physical ways that are appropriate to the kind of relationship you're in. And at the same time, he allows you to make your own decisions rather than control you. So we learn to love ourselves when we learn to give ourselves these same five A's. For instance, we pay attention to our particular needs. And I'm sorry, I gave you the wrong page. I said 51. Let's see here. I'm sorry, I was on 45. Starts at the bottom of 44. So I'm paying close attention to what I feel, how I talk to myself, how I judge myself. I'm working on letting go of negative statements against myself. I'm accepting myself, which means I accept what I feel in this moment. Appreciation, I value and congratulate myself on how I'm handling life so far. I show affection for myself by taking care of my body, and I allow the world to take the shape it's going to take. I let the chips fall where they may, and I trust myself to pick them up and make something of them. That's how we would apply the five A's that came to us from others to ourselves. Everybody call? So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that because I want to go to now to 51, where I have my technique. What if instead of giving yourself these five A's, you notice that you judge yourself and sometimes even engage in self-loathing? What if you're passing judgments on yourself and you're criticizing yourself? That's called the inner critic. And it's the opposite of loving yourself. So the way we work with this, I have my practice here. And you start with admitting that you feel pain in these judgments on yourself. It's really important to start this way. What I'm doing right now is injuring myself. I am hurting myself when I talk to myself in this way, when I put myself down. So you admit that. You admit that you're injuring yourself. And then secondly, you make the connection to how other people in the course of life, especially in childhood, said the same thing about you. So now you're noticing that you inherited this. You allow yourself to feel the pain, not only in yourself, because it's painful to criticize yourself and feel bad about yourself. So you're admitting the pain both in yourself and in the people who originally hurt you in that way. So you're starting to have some compassion for parents for the ways that they put you down. And then, and this is so important, you act as if this does not design your way of living, but no longer gets in the way. So I have here, we act in the opposite way to the voice's dictates. For instance, if the voice says, you are selfish, we do one little act of generosity that day, the first opportunity that comes along. And this shows us that the inner critic's voice was incorrect. This is a really good practice. So, notice the pain in the experience of having an inner critic. Notice where it came from. Allow yourself to feel it. Have compassion for those who originally inserted it into your consciousness. Then act in some way that shows I'm not really like that. And then finally, you can use your affirmation. More and more, I appreciate myself as a generous person. That will be on that topic. What if the message was, you'll never be successful? I notice how injurious that feels. I remember that my parents said that about me and to me. I let myself feel the pain of not feeling that I'll be successful. And I have compassion for those who said that to me. But now I do something that shows that I can be successful, no matter how small. And then I have my affirmation. Each day, in every way, I am becoming more successful at being a loving person. Success not connected to money and achievement, but you're bringing it to a higher level. I may not be totally successful in finances, but I'm highly successful in caring connections. Does this make sense to you? Ron?
Dave, I wanted to share with the group something. When I hear my inner critic comes out, or I'm feeling supercharged about something that's not positive, I ask myself, how old do I feel right now? If I feel less than my age, that really helps that inner critic calm down. And then I can proceed through these steps you are articulating. It's a very helpful personal intervention.
Thank you, Ron. So that would be another option. Our overall topic for this half of the talk is how you love yourself. So now we're looking at a way to love yourself is to reverse the unloving messages that come from the inner critic. And how do I reverse them? I make contact with the pain in the statement and with the origin of it. And then I do something that shows it's not altogether true. And then I use an affirmation or a prayer that helps me keep it in my consciousness. All right, so I want to just end before we take our break. Over on page 52, you can take a quick look. This approach lays down new neural pathways in your brain that can override the old ones. So every time the inner critic speaks now, you go into this little practice. It starts to change the way your brain holds something. So now it holds it in a new way. It connects it to an empowerment because the inner critic thrives on disempowering you. When you have a practice that you're using in response to the attempt to disempower you, that is making you more powerful, that reduces the wallop of the inner critic, and that's how the neural pathways change. So you're desensitizing yourself, basically. And then I want to go down to that last paragraph on page 52. A final word on what makes this practice work. Our inadequacies are not to be construed as proof of how bad we are, but of how human we are. The best position to be in for loving ourselves, that is to begin. When you hear yourself say, "I'm so messed up," say instead, "This too is workable, since my inner inclination toward healing is stronger than any fault I may believe I have. Right here, right now, I have everything required for my three goals in life: health, happiness, and personal growth." This is how you change your programming. That went all the way back to childhood. You are no longer tied to the judgments that others have made about you. You are now committed to trusting your own inner goodness. God within, Buddha nature. It is this alignment to your goodness that makes you more apt to love yourself and others. To recognize this inner goodness as our Buddha nature, as God within, Christ consciousness, higher power than ego, is to latch on to spiritual support for your work, what we all need so much. So that's the final comment. That when you realize that, oh, I have goodness in me, that's the equivalent of I have God in me, I have God energy in me. And so you complete your psychological practice, which is what this is. This is psychological work, by connecting it to a spiritual support. It's not just connecting it to a realization that we humans have a divine capacity. It's also turning to that divine capacity for support, and realizing that it's always there for us. "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me." And I remember in the seminary, one of the professors said to us once, "The entire Bible is summed up in those words, 'for thou art with me.'" That's what the whole thing is about. Okay, so we'll take a short break and then we'll come back. Okay. You have a question? Oh, okay.
I wanted to share something.
Okay, go ahead.
I realized in the last umpteen years that I had put Little Lou, my name is Mary Lou, Little Lou in a cave. And when I was at a retreat, probably La Casa, we did a guided meditation, and I walked into a rock and was a cave, and there was Little Lou, and I took her out. And Little Lou didn't know how to play. And since that time, I've become more playful. I feel Little Lou inside. Well, Little Lou didn't like that inner critic. And so I told Little Critic to go play, my inner critic to go play. Not with Little Lou. Little Lou stayed with me. But I found that it worked. It worked for me, for where I was at. Yeah. And I told it to go play, and once in a while I have to, because I found that inner critic made me more judgmental toward others than the head, and that just disturbed me a lot. So now I've come to the place in the last couple of years, go play, I tell ego, go play with inner critic.
And okay,
there's
well,
something
thank you. All right. Okay, so we'll see you in about 10 minutes.